We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Here's a question for you to think about a little bit as we begin the show. Is there anything in the world that is as important as oil? Our guest for this hour, journalist Stephen Solomon, says that was something he was puzzling over, and then he says it really didn't take very much in the way of research to come up with an answer. The answer is water. He argues that freshwater scarcity is becoming the oil of the 21st century, and that is not surprising, he says, because water has always been a major force in shaping the destiny of great powers. This morning in this hour of the program, we will talk about some of what you'll find in his new book, Water. The subtitle is The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. HarperCollins is the publisher on the book. Our guest, Stephen Solomon, is a journalist. He's written for a number of publications, including The New York Times, Business Week, The Economist, Forbes, and Esquire. He's also done commentary for the NPR program Marketplace, and he's also the author of The Confidence Game, and he makes his home in Washington, D.C. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. As we move here through the hour, we have two numbers for you to use if you were here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. You may also email will-talk@illinois.edu, and any way you do it, it'll help us if you keep your comments brief. That way we can keep moving along, get in as many callers as possible. Mr. Solomon, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Just to do some numbers first, I guess we could talk about what we know about the available supply of fresh water and what we know about people and the need. Are we getting anywhere close to the point where demand is going to outstrip supply?
Well, we're already there. We're beyond it in many places in the world. Of course, the United States is a water wealthy nation, and we are don't feel it nearly to the extent in our country. But the work that's been done on the Millennium Ecosystem report, for example, I think emphasizes that perhaps in many parts of the world we're overdrawing the available sustainable water resources by as much as a fourth. India, for example, is using pumping groundwater to produce food that is not going to be available to them, that water, in the near future. So they're going to start to have to import food as a result of that. Hmm. We're seeing numbers around the world, of course, where there is a mismatch in poor organization that is causing about a billion people to go without adequate clean water within their within reasonable distance to their home, and about $2.5 billion without adequate sanitary services. That's not necessarily a shortage problem as much as it is necessarily an organization problem. But we are overdrawing the ecosystems that support our society and our civilization in many places, and it's leading to failed states, as we saw, for example, in Yemen is a country that has severe problems. Mm-hmm. And one that's on the brink right now is Pakistan.
Yeah, I would just not very long ago I had a conversation with someone here on the program about Yemen, and learned many things about Yemen that I did not know. And one of the things that's very striking, and I'm sure is of concern, the capital in Yemen. It is thought they're rapidly drawing down their available water, and it is thought that it could be the first major city in the world to actually run out of water.
That's true. The problem with Yemen, of course, it's because it's on a high altitude, and they've been and water to pump water up from lower areas is very difficult, and they need energy to do it. And they also happen to be quite low on their oil reserves, if not completely gone. So their water tables have been plunging, both from population pressures, because that's always underlies many of the water shortage problems around the world. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they don't have a ready source of even pumping water that they might have elsewhere to their capital. So they've basically there's been violence in the rural areas over water wells and tribal violence, and I'm told that some of the al-Qaeda bases that are there are located in some of these intermediate zones where the government doesn't control the territory.
Yeah. We were talking about the United States being water rich. Now, there are certainly parts of the country that have been for some time concerned about water, but particularly the West. But I think it is true, and I imagine you might say that it's underappreciated just how significant this resource, both, say, for agriculture, for human use, for power generation, just how important that resource has been in the development of the United States.
Absolutely. Two points on that. First of all, I think that America's got, let's say, five times more water per person than China does, just to take for an example. It's an economic – we could be a mini Saudi Arabia of water to produce the goods and the food that the rest of the world that doesn't have enough water to produce these things is going to need if we organized our water resources as efficiently, say, as an Israel or an Australia. Well, we haven't done that, but we have this potential to do it, and we ought to. The history of the United States, if you want to go back and look at our water resources, is that you could break the United States down into three zones that are hydrologic zones. The east coast of the United States, all the way through the Mississippi Valley, is rainy and rain-fed. You know that very well, and very wealthy in natural rivers and water power from those rivers, which we exploited in the first half of our history. And when the Erie Canal was built, it really, you know, led to a very rapid development of that portion of our country. The second waterscape that we've got are the seas. And it was the Panama Canal that, once we built that really linked up our resources of our east and our west coasts and, of course, gave us great naval power as well. And then the west was a whole other problem because it is arid. And there was no way to develop it without irrigation. And this was the great challenge that Teddy Roosevelt and others took up and ultimately led to the Hoover Dam and the rest of the great dams that followed and really transformed the United States. So it's the linking up of these three different regions that gave a great deal of growth and energy to the United States. And you see the same thing happening when I took in this book throughout history. Wherever they've linked up water resources and other resources, because that's what water does, it's a great catalyst, it leads to growth periods.
And I think it's also true, though, and I think it's something that is getting more attention here in the United States, that people living in this country in places where they have always taken plentiful water supply for granted are starting to have to think more about it. It's certainly true of the Midwest. It's, interestingly enough, true of a place like Florida, where you can be within view of water, but water can be a problem. So I think certainly it is something that people in the United States are having to start to think more about in a way, at least in some parts of the country, in a way that they have not in the past.
Almost everywhere, actually. The water politics are becoming more and more visible, even at the national level. We saw the drought in the southeast, for example, in Georgia. It was exposed that they basically have ignored the costs of maintaining their water infrastructure over the year to account for their development. So they were resorting to things like trying to move their state border a few miles towards the Tennessee River to try to draw water from the Tennessee River. That didn't fly. And then to get into fights with their neighboring states downriver to get a larger share. You see it in your area, in Lake the Great Lakes have formed a compact of disputive groups came together to say, let's preserve the quality of the Great Lakes as best we can, and that's a great thing. But the force that drove them together was saying, we're afraid that people outside the region are going to try to import our water, take it away from our region. So the condition is we want to keep it in the Great Lakes. Congress ratified that in 2008. Obviously, in the West, we've seen politics on the Klamath River where the national government got involved, the administration got involved, and Florida and California to this day is driven by ecosystem collapse, really, in the Delta that is forcing the groups to try to come together in some kind of a way to conserve a little bit better.
Let me introduce again our guest, Stephen Solomon. He's a journalist, has written for a number of publications, and is author of a new book that's titled Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. It's published by HarperCollins. It's just out recently, and it takes a look at the importance of water as a resource across time and about how it is that it's something that's been involved in both the rise and fall of civilizations. It's the kind of thing that people have gone to war over, and it is a ready present and future concern as we think about how it is that we can satisfy the demand for fresh water of people around the world. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe I'll just ask right at this point a question that I'm sure comes up when you talk about this all the time. People make the observation that, well, you know, we have a lot of water on this planet. It just happens to be salt water. What is the potential of desalination for meeting the demands, world's demand for fresh water?
In the long run, it may be great, and the prices have come down. The technology is improving rapidly, but it has several has two big problems to be able to solve in the short and intermediate term. Our problem, one is that water is very heavy, and the desal also burns a lot of energy. So if you are going to move, if you're going to create the water, you got to burn a lot of energy and use a lot of cost. That's bad for global warming. And it's also uneconomic at the moment. To move it inland or move it over long distances, also similar problem. So you've got to come up with some solutions to that, those problems, and also things like solar or wind powered might be the way to make the breakthrough that does make it economic. But you're starting from such a tiny base of built-in infrastructure that even with a technological breakthrough, you're not going to get a build-up rapidly and rapid enough to be able to really solve the crisis points that are developing around the world.
Mm-hmm. So just to go back to a step to make sure that we make this point clear, if you look at the people and you look at the demand and then you look at the supply, is the primary issue one of distribution? It's not that the earth doesn't have enough fresh water for all of the
people. That's true. That is true.
Okay.
Water is the only renewable valuable resource, and it recycles through the water cycle, as you know, and then replenishes the rivers and the lakes, which is where we primarily get our water from. And there is a lot of water underground that we are tapping, but is not replenishable. So once we use it, some of it is replenishable, but a lot of it is not replenishable because it's deep fossil aquifer. For example, in the Midwest, there's an aquifer the size of Lake Huron under there that has converted the Dust Bowl into the cornucopia that it is. But we ended up drawing down too fast in the beginning, so we've had to conserve the way that we use the water there. And that's fine to use those things that way. There's also a great unevenness of distribution around the planet, and a lot of the water falls in places that people don't live or can't use it, up in the Arctic or in cold places and such. So you find that in areas that are it's not only arid places, some places get too much water, or get worse than that, they get unpredictable swings between floods and droughts, the monsoonal regions of the world. And so the mismatch is population and the location of available water is the principal problem today, and therefore the overdrawing of resources that are non-renewable, like for example groundwater, or building large aqueducts that try to transport water from one part of a country to another that might be a short-term solution but doesn't work in the long run.
Let's talk a little bit about the water in history, which is something that you do in the book. And you did just talk a little bit ago about the importance of water as a natural resource in development of the United States. But if you, ask this question, is it possible to say that a particular civilization appeared and flourished in the place that it did because of the availability of water in that place? And it was just a matter of the fact that it was there. And so that's where a particular civilization flowered.
Well, absolutely. First of all, almost every city and great location is built along a waterway that for transport purposes and for drinking and for some industries. But the classic is the beginning of civilization itself in Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Indus Valley. They were built along rivers that they could large rivers that were actually in not otherwise hospitable regions because it was too dry down there, and but the water resource, it was a flooding river that they could irrigate with, and the overflow from the floods could fertilize the ground, and they were able to marshal a labor on a large scale to work those irrigation ditches and other elements of their society to build the beginning of what we call civilization. And the pyramid, then they mobilized those same forces for building pyramids and making armies. And it all was in an arid zone that got little rainfall and had little else to commend it except that it was alongside these rivers.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that's a story that you can see repeated other places, and you can trace it right through, certainly up to the industrial era.
Well, that's true. If you want to look at the industrial age, we've got the seminal invention there was the steam engine, water in another form. But where did it develop? It developed in an area right along the very small rivers in the Midlands of England, where they could bring in coal from the coal mines, could come in on canals and these navigable rivers to these little cities where they could make iron, and they could use the steam to produce iron. And then the factories were also driven by first by water power along those rivers, and then by the steam engine itself.
I'm sure that it is for people who have a good supply of water, they could manage that even better by greater efficiency, by using it in sustainable ways, and we can talk about that. But if you go to those places where there are people and there is demand, but a questionable or unreliable supply, particularly if it is people who live in arid or semi-arid regions, given the problems with transportation that you talked about before, and given the fact that people will fight over the supply, what is it possible to do to provide water to a place like that?
You have to reorganize. I mean, to the extent that they have absolute shortages, let's just take the Middle East just as one case, because each zone is a little different depending on its problem. The Middle East ran out of water probably from about the 1970s and 1980s. That is, they didn't have enough water to grow food to feed their populations. We're facing a prospect in the world where 3.6 billion people are going to be in that condition in the next 15 years. So that's a whole other scale of problem, a water have-not problem. But in the Middle East, what you do is you conserve, you use a lot less, you hopefully get the users together, and you find the ways of sharing the water and trying to cooperate to make the best you got for what you got, and then you try to import the goods and the food that you need from elsewhere. And that means you've got to produce something of value that people want to trade for. So that's one strategy that you can deal with. You try to store water through not just necessarily big dams, but there's other ways of capturing water and storing it as well through small scale technologies. The Middle East has had these great ganats, they call them, where they carved into the rock. They found a spring source and carved through the rock water that brought water from the mountain aquifers that right down into the cities. I think Tehran until not too long ago, 50, 60 years ago, got all its water from that source. They're sort of versions of the aqueducts that Rome had or that we have in New York and elsewhere.
You gave some examples of civilizations that were really born and flourished because they were located in a place where there was water, and you talked about the fact that, in fact, you look at where are the big, historically big cities, and that they tend to be on waterways. Conflict. Now, this is also something that people go to war over the control of natural resources. Are there examples where people have actually fought wars over water?
Well, of course, the one of the famous quotes, even from the UN former Secretary General Boutros Ghali, who said, 20th century we fought wars over oil, and we're going to fight wars over water in the 21st century. The truth is that there are very few instances of that in actual wars over water itself. Water is often one of the factors that maybe, you know, brings countries into conflict, thinking of the Israeli war in 1967 with the Arabs. It was preceded by 2 years of fighting over water in that region in the north, and some missile fire and back and forth, and some attacks from the Palestinian the PLO guerrilla faction. And people don't even realize in that war, the 67 war, Israel gained 2/3 of its current water supply by the land it occupied, but it didn't go for the water. It went for defensive reasons. The water was a component of it, but today that water is critical to the negotiations for peace. And so when Syria and Israel were secretly negotiating in 2008 on the Golan Heights give back, where 1/3 of the water comes from, under the auspices of the Turks, who are the region's water superpower, the new superpower in the region because of their control of the Tigris, Euphrates, and other water resources, the access to the Sea of Galilee, which is the main water source there, was a critical element in that negotiation that ultimately failed.
We are just about at our midpoint here of this hour of Focus 580. Stephen Solomon is our guest. He's a journalist. He's written for The New York Times, Business Week, The Economist, Forbes, Esquire. He's done commentary for the NPR program Marketplace. He makes his home in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a newly published book titled Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. It's published by HarperCollins. And it takes a look at water over history, the role it has played in the rise and fall of civilizations, the fact that there have been conflicts related to water, and there are at least some people who think that there could be conflict in the world in the future about water, that it is as important, it may be increasingly more important than oil, for example. The book is out there in the bookstore now if you want to take a look at it, and questions are certainly welcome here on this program. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So that's if you'd like to call in, and it would be a long-distance call. Use that number. Emails are welcome as well, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm sure that that waste is a big issue. Everything from, on the one hand, agricultural use, where it's used in a very inefficient way, to the other end, where we, I think that we know that in a lot of places around this country, maybe other places as well, that municipal water systems are old and that they actually leak. And a lot of water is wasted that way. What can you say about waste, inefficiency, and the potential for literally tightening the system up so that we get the most out of the water we have?
Well, that's essential. That's the first thing. You don't want to pollute the water you got, and you don't want to let it leak away and waste it. And then you want to direct it towards more efficient, make sure you direct it towards more efficient uses. On the waste side, of course, the infrastructure is old, and the cities are trying to do some work. New York City, people don't really know this, has been involved in a sort of a race with time over the last 50 years, slow-motion race, building a new distribution tunnel under the city because the old ones are so old that they can't even shut them off for fear that they would collapse under New York, and then parts of Manhattan would have to be, probably evacuated, large parts of the city. So that's the kind of a project that's going on. Around the world, there are cities losing 40-50% of their water supply, like Mexico City and New Delhi. So that's one element of the problem. Another element, though, is on the pollution side. People don't realize that 40% of our water, drinking water today, has been contaminated with elements and germs. This came out in the New York Times investigative series on the Environmental Protection Agency, because basically in the last 10 years, the EPA stopped doing enforcement effectively for water pollution. So 20 million Americans are getting sick each year because of contaminated water, a lot of it groundwater and such. So that's a kind of a scandalous situation that doesn't make a lot of sense for drinking. And sometimes in places of the world, like in China, which has got just awful pollution problems, and frankly, their water problem is an Achilles heel for their continued growth. Some of that water is so poor quality they can't even use it in industry. But the real big one is agriculture, because agriculture is essentially unregulated. Irrigation agriculture gets its water basically almost for free, if in some cases for free, and is not using it efficiently at all. And in flood irrigation, for example, 50% of the water never even reaches the plant roots, and then washes off with all the fertilizer and the rest of the pollutants into the places like the Mississippi River, and then floats down into the Gulf of Mexico and forms this dead zone that we've got that's the size of Massachusetts and growing, where even fish can't live. So, you know, these are terrible problems that should be easily soluble, and we in our country have all the means to do it. There are places in the world where we don't have the institutions that are even able to begin to get their arms around the problem.
And there it sounds as if it's a matter of will and also spending what it would take. It's not that we don't know how to do it.
Well, my argument is this. We should really marshal the market forces, let market forces really operate in the water market. We haven't allowed them to because of these political subsidies that are out there, both for on the supply side and on allowing certain pollution to take place. When the Clean Water Act came into being in the 1970s, it did spur an enormous efficiency gains in industry and in cities who are recycling their water and are trying to use less water so that they don't have to clean so much and spend the energy and cost to do so. That's been really good, but it didn't apply to about 70% of the water market in the country. So one thing that we've seen is the first three quarters. I mean, this works. So you want to deregulate on the one side so that the free market forces can begin to operate and allocate efficiently. On the other side, you want a golden rule that says everybody's got to return the water to the ecosystem in the same condition, clean condition that they took it out, so the next guy has a fair use of it. Pretty simple rule. But we're unfortunately so filled with political subsidies and political special interests that we're blocked.
So, well, just one more point here, and I'll go on to some callers. It is what I hear you saying that, at least for a lot of people, that water is too cheap.
Yeah, I mean, there are those who have special interests, irrigated agriculture being the biggest one.
Our guest is part of Focus 580, again, Stephen Solomon, and we're talking about the water, the issue of water, the availability of water, the demand. It's all the subject of his book of that title, Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, Civilization, published by HarperCollins. We have a caller here. We'll get right to the first in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. My major point I don't expect a sympathetic response to after you're advocating deregulation and free markets because, I've had very little faith in either of those that's ever really existing and really being efficacious. Since you did mention Yemen as the first country in the world where there could be a complete collapse, I thought I'd visit, ask you to, well, this is just an aside, I guess. I'm sorry, I'm digressing. But Yemen voted against Bush 1's authorization for war, and they were cut off from aid. It wasn't very much money, but I gather it extended until today. Now the aid that's going in is military aid. So there was this Yemen precedent set. If you buck the United States, you don't get any aid. I gather other countries may have been aiding, but the battles with the Saudis obviously are such there's a history of that underdevelopment. As far as a grand water issue, global warming has already had an effect. Lake Chad is very dry; it's withering away, and it was sort of the pump for the ecosystem, the whole region, and it's really a large part of the the conflict in that whole region, which obviously includes Darfur. But there's that, but I don't expect sympathetic on this, but you know, Bechtel and Suez, I think, should be mentioned, because this corporate solution and perhaps free market, obviously these companies are very powerful and they make political demands and capture states right and left. But they're in the forefront of supposed a development program, but they've been pushed back in a lot of places. Bechtel was pushed out of Bolivia because they were tripling them or more the rate of water and cost, and they were, part of their deal was that people couldn't use catchments. They couldn't collect water like they historically had been. And I believe Bechtel still has a lawsuit against Bolivia. I don't know if it's ever been settled, but that's those are major issues, and I had some more, but I guess I should hang up and let
them well, let's get some. We'll give the guest a chance to make some response. Go ahead.
Okay. Right, fine. First of all, you bring up many good points, and to take the last one first, the case of Bechtel and Bolivia and the capturing of countries by the large water companies. Yeah, this is, of course, a problem. There's a great film, which you probably have seen, a documentary called Flow that I just looked at the other day, which I think makes the case as strongly as you can. The case in Bolivia, though, I'm not saying that there's not a problem with what you're calling privatized or free market solutions. They're actually contracts made by the government with a company. They've made a poor contract and a very stupid one in the case in those countries, and that's where we're talking about a failure of the institutions, of the governing institutions, to do what's right. You'll see in my free market. Advocacy of free market, freeing up the markets, that is, getting rid of the political subsidies that exist and distortions that really are going not to the poor people but largely to special interests that are corporate interests, by the way, the agribusinesses, that I'm also saying you've got to have, at the same time, very strong social rules on the ecosystems themselves, and you need governance of what terms those markets, free markets, are going to operate on. So it's a compact, as all things are, between markets and governments. And it's not just, you know, government get out of the way and we let the ecosystems become a dumping ground for everybody else, the commons being such. The other point I would like to just mention is the global warming one, because it's critical. People haven't made the connected the dots all the time between global warming and water, but they're inseparable, just as it is with energy and food. Global warming exacerbates the water crisis. It creates more floods and at unpredictable time, floods and droughts. The glacier melts are a huge problem in the Himalayas, and Pakistan, for example, is going to lose one-third of its water in the coming years from the glacier melt on the Indus River, at the same time that its population is growing 30%. So it's a terrible scissor effect. Lake Chad is a case where there was both possibly a global warming component, but also the neighboring states were both developing their water, taking water out of the lake without any coordination or cooperation. And so they overdrew that resource, and it has virtually disappeared.
You know, just I guess it reminds me of the problem. Well, I suppose it's kind of the problem of the commons. It's something that we've talked about here, for example, where in this part of the state we're drawing water from an aquifer, the Mahomet Aquifer, and it is a very significant resource. But here, as population has grown and there have been increasing demands placed on it, I think that a lot of people who are interested, concerned about the issue of water, say, really what must happen, and I think to some extent it has, is that all of the stakeholders here have to get together to literally sit down at a table and acknowledge the fact that this is a common resource and that everyone has to work together so that that resource can be managed in a sustainable way, so that everyone can benefit, but that benefits can be spread out.
And you know, you got it exactly right.
And it seems though you face the same challenge on the international level, and there I suppose it gets more difficult if what you're talking about is competing governments, and I suppose here on a smaller scale, it's the same thing because they are competing governments, at least it's not different countries trying to decide how they're going to manage the resource.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we have the tragedy of the commons occurring in water resources, especially those that are not even visible, like the groundwater or the ones that are in the snowpacks and the glaciers that are sort of reservoirs of nature's own reservoirs. We've had different groups. There are farm and take the Klamath River out in Oregon, which is really heated one. I mean, you've got farmers, fishermen. You've got the environmental groups and the industry, the hydropower industry, were basically fighting over it until all those salmon died out there. The 70,000, they destroyed the fishery by not putting enough water in the river, by diverting it all to the farmers, basically for political reasons. And they all realized, wait a minute, this is not going to fly. This is not. We're all going to lose in this. And that's what brings people together in the end, because we need water to live. Everybody does. And that's why some people hope that water is going to be the vehicle of peace and cooperation. I mean, even the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Jordanians have continued to meet, even during the Intifada and during the times that they were technically at war with one another, in picnic, what they call them, picnic table talks along the Jordan River. So there's something about water that does, you know, bring people to cooperate and work together, and sometimes... Occasionally, we've been able to make these large basin agreements about how to manage and allocate the water amongst ourselves.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me introduce again the guest, Stephen Solomon. He's a journalist, written for a number of publications, including New York Times Business Week, The Economist, Forbes. He is the author of a recently published book. The title is Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. The publisher, HarperCollins. It's just out now. You can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore or the library if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome, too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. So I understand that part of what you got you interested in this was the fact that you were involved in a project in Kenya, something that I think that you got into because your wife was involved in this. And I'm sort of interested in the component of this that has to do with development work in the developing world and how it is that people are trying to, again, to get at this efficiency of use issue. Try to implement, you know, small-scale appropriate technologies to this problem.
Well, in the first instance, the Kenya project that you allude to is it was simply a question of there are about a billion people around the world who don't live close enough to any clean freshwater resource, and therefore have to walk 2, 3, 4 hours a day carrying this very heavy substance. It weighs 20% more than oil, 8 1/3 pounds per gallon, and you need several of those gallons for your family, and that means that children don't go to school. It means women, it's largely women who are obliged to do this, are not doing productive work. So we got involved in my wife was the instigator, but I'm pleased to my daughters too came along to raise a little bit of money to lay water pipes between a borehole that pumped the water where the women and children were walking to each day, to the village itself. And it didn't cost very much money. It probably cost only about, I think, $50 to $100 per person when you prorated it out to bring the fresh water to where they were. And in this level of meaning, it is so gigantic a change in people's lives. For all those hours that they now suddenly can use on human development and productive work, that you just see and can't help but feel the enormous importance of it in their lives. And they expressed it, of course, in ways that I'll never forget. And you also see the inequities, the tremendous inequities that are built into the way that the disadvantages that they have and the advantages that, say, we who have piped water at our house have. In terms of competition and in a world economy where people are living side by side and competing, in effect, for resources. So one of the great challenges of the world out there, and the UN has established it as a goal, is to try to halve the number of people who have access to clean, fresh water, and the 2.5 billion who don't have sanitary services. Now these are, it's the number one killer of people around the world, and makes people sick, of course, by far. I mean, it's not even close. So water, drinking water or having access to water that is contaminated is a terrible scourge. The problem is not so much, well, it is partly a resource problem, and there are many groups trying to work on this, and we've seen everything from Jessica Biel climbing up Mount Kilimanjaro to bring attention to it, to other celebrities who have NGOs working in this area. But yet, there's still a large resource problem, but there's also something about how to make these solutions when you build them. Let's say you build a well pump. You know, well, how do you make sure that it's maintainable? When the pieces break, that you can fix it. Mm-hmm. That there are people on the ground who are incentivized to take care of it. And that's been sort of a sticking point and a problem.
Right. We have a number of callers now, and we'll try to get in as many as we can. I don't know if we can do them all, but certainly callers will help us by keeping their comments brief, so that way we can get as many as we can. Starting with Heffingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. A question. The fresh water as opposed to salt water, can the fresh water support the projection of 12 billion people in the near future? Thank you.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head on the problem. I haven't seen 12 billion. I've seen 9 billion as the projection by 2050. The way that water is organized today, the answer is no. In fact, we can't even really sustain the 6.5 billion we are today the way it is organized. We have to use the existing water that we've got very much more productively, and then hope for some of the technological breakthroughs like desal that we were talking about before.
All right. On to back here for a local caller. Line 1, Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. I'm a retired geologist and recently spent 2 years with the Regional Water Supply Planning Committee that studied surface and groundwater supplies in the belt of counties between the Indiana line and Illinois River that includes Champaign, 15 counties. I don't think the fact that we issued a final report or the fact that the research effort was publicized as making progress should satisfy any thinking citizen of the state or this region that anything significant has been done. Quite frankly, the Mahomet Aquifer is a vital regional water supply resource. Use of it over the past 50 years has changed the dynamics of the system. It's affecting the way water flows across the surface of these counties. It's affecting the it's changed the direction of flow from the aquifer. Champaign-Urbana withdrawals, for example, are pulling water from adjacent counties in all directions, a fact which doesn't seem to impress those counties yet. We're not causing water to drop by feet, but it is a measurable in wells in those areas. But it is measurable. This aquifer is not a renewable water resource in the ordinary sense. That is to say, recharge from the surface, water percolating down, will reach it in 1,000 years or so, which is really beyond the scale of human activity, political, social activity that we can have some influence. Now, I'm pessimistic because, frankly, in a water-abundant state like Illinois, the regulations that control use of water are very minimal. This is not like a western, droughty, western semi-arid state where water rights are jealously guarded and worked out over a century or more. We have minimal water regulations. There's a lot of regulations, federal and state, that have to do with pollution and that sort of thing, but not control of use.
Right.
State government. Well, what can we say about state government at present? It's confused. It's going bankrupt. This project that I worked on, which was reputedly a vital project, and I don't deny, and I wouldn't contradict that assessment, had its funding withdrawn in the third year. And a very minimal report was published because we couldn't fund the finish the scientific work that would have drawn a lot of things together.
Yeah, I need to jump in. I hope the caller forgive me because I think what you're saying is very important. And this is something that we've tried to talk about here some on the program, and I expect that we will try to stay on top of and get back to the issue. And certainly by talking about the fact that people were talking about it, I certainly didn't want to suggest that this was a problem that somehow had been solved or adequately dealt with, because I think everything the caller says is perfectly correct. I think the bottom line is, I suppose, for people here in this part of the country, they should be cognizant of the fact that water is, for us right here in central Illinois, water is a significant issue. That it's not just, you know, this issue of is there enough water and how do we use it and how do we use it in a sustainable way. It's not just an issue for the other side of the globe and for people in China and for people in Africa. Well, it's an issue for us right here.
Absolutely. And we have an opportunity to actually have a growth opportunities by using our water resources wisely and in a sustainable way. This is a perfect example of something that's out of sight and therefore out of mind. And if we would be wise about it, we may be able to actually increase our growth in the state and in across the country as a result, because yeah, they're knock-on effects.
Yeah. Let us continue, and we'll go next to someone in line two, I believe, in Urbana. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
This sort of built on the last question, and it has to do with the guest's recommendation of markets to help solve the water problem. Something I generally agree with, and I know worked pretty well in California, but it's partly because of all the water infrastructure there and the canals, maybe more than anywhere else, water is close to a fungible resource like money, where markets work so well. But in general, it's so hard to transport, you end up with very localized situations if you try to have a market and put a cost on water and rely on markets to function that way. Similarly to the way electricity, when we tried to do it purely by a market force, was limited by the power grid and by constraints on being able to move the electricity around. So my question, though, is really, again, a local situation here where we have plenty of water, not an overwhelming demand on the water yet. How do you keep a local citizen who wants to do the right thing and conserve water from basically being cynical about what's the result of that water that they, you know, their reduced demand is saving? You'd like to think that it's somehow making the ecosystem better or keeping the Mahomet Aquifer full. But at the same time, water rates have gone up here locally. I think our water utility doubled its pumping capacity west of town. So, again, the local situation seems to be, regardless of what we may all save and do here, the aggregate pumping effort is going to double, at least based on what the infrastructure is going to be. So the idea of, conserving water, but to what effect? Are you just kind of depressing the price and making it available for someone else to come in
right
and use?
Yeah. Well, I would say, I have two quick answers to you on these. The rates probably are a function of the energy costs involved in pumping the water more than the actual water itself. Almost nowhere is the water really valued very much. It's the, as you mentioned before, it's the infrastructure cost of maintaining. That is, filtering the water, treating the wastewater that where it goes out afterwards, and that the largest component of that is not the water itself, the value of the water itself, but the energy costs and employment costs of doing that. to be cynical, to not be cynical, it's not an easy situation, obviously, and I think it's going to take a lot of organization from the ground up, people like yourself working with other people like yourself, to try to hold accountable the local politicians to the standards that we demand. And as for your question about the fungibility question, how you could handle some of that, you have trading in water rights is beginning to take place. And it's true that some places you need canals and you need to have access, but you can also sometimes swap the rights to water that, Australia has a very extensive system in trading water rights, which I invite you to look at, where they do it over the mobile telephones are trading water rights, and it's been very successful in allocating water to the most efficient users there, and there is a price on the water.
Very quickly here, we'll try to get one more caller. Champagne, line 3. Go ahead.
Yes, just a couple lighter observations. I read about a small town on the coast of Chile. It was a desertified area, and they trucked in all their water. But some clever innovators put up large wall screens, you might say, of plastic netting, maybe something like they use in construction areas. And then they had troughs underneath, and every night the sea mist would come in, and that all condensed, and they collected it, and so they don't need a truck in water anymore. I thought that was a nice thing. And then the other one is a question. The Phoenicians lived on a rocky fortress island. What did they do, hauling jars of water in?
Well, two things. First of all, you're talking about capturing the fog, I think they call it, down in Chile, in the high desert that they've got, one of the more arid places on the earth. That's a great local solution, by the way. The Bushmen in Africa actually captured the drops off the leaves on the trees and such. The Phoenicians are great. I cover them extensively in the book, Water, that I just completed. They're a great sea trading society, but they also happen to live near where Lebanon, is, and that's actually a number of rivers that are nearby there, and plenty of springs and such. So they, given the population pressures that they had, which were limited, they had cisterns and networks like that took care of their immediate needs.
We
were a great trading society.
We must stop there because we're at the end of the time. More in the book if you're interested in reading it. The title is Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization, published by HarperCollins, by our guest journalist Stephen Solomon. And Mr. Solomon, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Enjoyed it.